Welcome to Designer Threads, in which the minds behind some of your favorite games present their views and comments on gaming and whatever else matters, if anything. I'm Greg Kasavin, executive editor for GameSpot, and joining me today is Mr. Ron Gilbert. How you doing, Ron?
Just fine. Great to be here.
Cool. Ron Gilbert's got a long and storied career as a game developer, and some of his best-known works include the Monkey Island series of adventure games and the real-time strategy classic Total Annihilation. First off, let's get the important stuff out of the way. What's the deal with the high school play reenactment of The Secret of Monkey Island?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. The kid who did that emailed me because of my website and wanted permission to do the play. And of course, I don't own the rights to Monkey Island. So he wanted to know, well, how do I go about getting permission? So I told him that he should email Lucasfilm and, you know, be very professional. And I think if he presents himself really well, they may actually go for it. And they actually did, which was great.
Yeah.
So he wrote the whole thing and put on the play. And I think it's up on Google Video. You can actually watch the entire play up there.
Have you seen much?
I've seen a good chunk of it. Yeah. I didn't sit through the whole thing, but I have seen a good chunk of it. It's actually really interesting. I mean, he's very kind of true to the game in a way. I mean, it's a high school play, but
right.
It's very good. It's very flattering.
Yeah. Were you surprised that someone who from, I guess, a younger generation was able to pick up on it? It's a game from before the time of a guy like that, right?
Yeah, I'm always surprised by the Monkey Island fans. I mean, I get a lot of email every single day from people who have played Monkey Island. And, you know, some of them were not alive when the first game came out.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I am always impressed that people are still playing it.
That's cool.
I'll hear from people who just started, you know, played the original or played number two just a couple of years ago because, you know, their dad had it or their mom right. had it and gave it to them. And yeah, I think that's great that they're still enjoying it.
Yeah, the games like that, since they're based around their stories and characters, they just hold up better than a game that, you know, had a bunch of whiz-bang graphics or something back in the day and relied on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing about those games is clearly if you look at them today, the graphics are, you know, nowhere near what the graphics are today. But those games weren't about the graphics. They were about the puzzles and they were about the stories. Where I think a lot of games today are really about the graphics. In some ways, they're right. just commercial tech demos more than anything. And those games aren't going to last because, you know, you're going to play them 10 years from now and they're just not going to be impressive because there isn't that same kind of gameplay that's divorced from the presentation.
Well, what do you think has brought that about? Do you think that's a change that's happened to gaming between the time that something like the original Monkey Island games are coming out and now?
Yeah, I think it's just an advancement in technology.
Right.
You know, new graphics cards come out, new consoles come out, and they're really pushing the technology on those. And so, you know, you have game developers, I mean, they're just hungry for that stuff. So they're going to go push that technology. And, you know, I think, you know, back when the original Monkey Island and the original Sierra games, you know, we didn't have that same kind of technology edge that we were pushing. You know, we had EGA graphics were the big advancement, you know, over CGA graphics.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, we were pushing a lot of things that didn't have to do with the technology really pushing forward.
Right.
Now, you know, every year it's a technology revolution that developers need to keep up with. And, you know, the hardcore gamers that are buying most of those games, that is what they're impressed with. So they want more and more of that stuff. And so
right.
it just becomes this cycle where they're just being fed.
Do you think that's going to plateau at all, though, like once these new game systems come out and kind of gain their footing? I mean, it is a closed platform after all. Developers might unlock some of the power that they didn't realize was there in their first crop of games, but at least they're not having to worry about what the next graphics card is going to be and so on, at least for a little while, right?
Well, I think the technology stuff will absolutely plateau, but it'll plateau in 20 or 25 years.
Wow.
It's true. People will figure out the 360 and the PS3, but then the PS4 and the
right.
Xbox, 1380 or whatever, will come out and we'll be right back into the cycle again. So I think what really has to happen is the technology needs to plateau to the point where it doesn't matter anymore.
Right.
And if, you know, if you kind of use the overused film analogy, I think that's kind of what you had. You know, with film it was all new and everybody was figuring it out. And then it just became, you know, it was an understood medium. The technology was so understood that, you know, you could just go out and make movies and you didn't have to worry about that. Now, I think, you know, a lot of special effects have kind of changed
yeah.
and CG animation has kind of stirred that all up. But there's still a lot of movies made today that have no CG in them that use the same techniques that, you know, people were using 50 years ago
right.
to make film.
Or the ones that do, they can't get by on that alone. People aren't just impressed by special effects as they were when, like, Terminator 2 or something came out.
Yeah, that's very true. I don't think people really go to movies for special effects.
Right.
They like them, and it's really great frosting, but there still has to be a cake there.
Right.
And I think games, in some ways, are still just a whole bunch of frosting people eat.
But you still like games, right?
I mean, I still play them. Hey, I love frosting.
What are some of your favorite games, like, from the last year or two or something?
What
kind of stuff do you play?
I think without a doubt the game that I've probably spent the most time playing is Animal Crossing on Nintendo DS. I think that's just a brilliant game. I mean, it's one of those games where, you know, if I had to pick a game that was near perfect, it would be Animal Crossing. You know,
yeah.
From kind of a design standpoint, everything just works. There's some UI things that drive me crazy about the game, but, you know, it's interesting because as you play the game more and more, some of their weird UI choices actually start to make sense from a design standpoint, which is a little bit weird. But
right.
I think, you know, Animal Crossing is a great game. I probably spent, I can't even count the number of hours on that.
And it's one of those games you could just hand off to just about anybody.
Yeah, it's a pretty accessible game.
Right. I took the risk of getting a imported Japanese pink DS and a copy of Animal Crossing for my wife for Christmas, and she hates games. Hate is maybe too strong a word, but she is highly, highly indifferent toward games, let's say, but she got hooked on it for months. So that paid off. I felt that game had something special to it like that as well. It's just, you know, goes to show that games don't have to be about kind of violent conflict to be interesting.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great game. I think, you know, the whole temporalness of it is really interesting, that it kind of runs in real time. And I think that really helps kind of with the addiction process, because you can't just put it away and come back a week later and assume that, you know, it'll pick up where you left off, because, you know, things are going on. And, you know, you're kind of going, gee, you know, even when my power's off, my little guys are living inside that card and they're running around and they're doing stuff. And I got to go figure out what it is. So I think it kind of drives that kind of daily addiction. I mean, even though I played it for, you know, 10 or 15, 20 minutes a day. I mean, it wasn't like I was playing it all day, but I played it every single day.
Right.
You know, you can't let your plants die. So.
Yeah. And KK Slider only comes in 8 p.m. Saturdays.
Yeah. So. You know, you have a problem when you're setting your alarm clock for the middle of the night to get up and, you know, go to the cafe to, you know, get the special guitar. So
right. The other thing I really like about that game is that it does sort of ration your time. So it gets you to play every day, but there's only really, unless you want to fish all day or something, there's only so much you could do on a given day. So it's not like the World of Warcraft, you know, heroin addiction.
I think that's one of the genius things about Animal Crossing, actually, is they really do only want you to play that game for, you know, 15, 20, half hour a day.
Right.
Because, yeah, it is a diminishing returns thing. And I think that's great. And I think that's, you know, very different than, like you said, World of Warcraft, where it's just about spending hours and hours and hours on there.
Do you play World of Warcraft at all?
I played it for quite a bit. I think it's an absolutely fabulous game. But, you know, I kind of lost interest after playing it, you know, for maybe 4 months or so.
Yeah. I got to level 60 and basically couldn't keep up with it. At that point, it was like spend 8 hours at a time raiding or don't play. So
yeah, it kind of becomes a grind. It becomes like work.
Right. Or like managing a football team or something. It's just a little too much pressure for me to, you know, have to apologize to 39 people if I had to use the bathroom or something. So
right. I think also with me, with massively multiplayer games, I enjoy, you know, playing alone. And anytime these games get in a situation where you have to now be a part of a large group in order to push yourself forward is where I kind of lose interest.
Yeah.
You know, World of Warcraft, you know, you can easily get through the levels 20s and 30s pretty much on your own in that game. And I think that was really kind of where I started to lose interest, when I had to team up with other people to move forward.
Right. What do you make of the fact that, you know, in Animal Crossing, you're interacting with these fictional characters, but they're smarter, interesting, more eloquent than the human beings behind a lot of the characters you meet. Have you ever noticed that? Or
I notice it all the time. I mean, you get very attached to the people in your town, and you know, you have somebody that's lived in your town for weeks and weeks and weeks, and then they tell you they're moving away, and it's like, you know, it's almost an emotional crisis.
Right.
You know,
well, you could stop them. You could come to their house as they're packing up and talk them out of it.
I've done that, and you know, I actually did talk somebody out of it after like 10 times of begging them to stay, and it was just scary how like relieved and happy I was that they said they were staying.
I don't know. I feel like a lot of the novelty of massively multiplayer games, just the idea that, oh man, I'm playing with real people, it's kind of gone by now. I mean, people play World of Warcraft because it's a fun game to kill monsters in and find stuff in. I don't know that the inherent aspect of just interacting with other people is what's appealing to people at this point.
Yeah, it is a little bit lost on me. That has never been a huge appeal to me. I mean, I would have been very happy with World of Warcraft if it had been a single player game, you know, where I was just playing it. I mean, it's nice to see people running around, but
yeah.
You know, I was a little bit put off. It's really the first massively multiplayer game that I've really gotten into. And it was a little, you know, put off about going up and talking to people and how not very interested people were in just having conversations. Everybody was so focused on getting their quest done.
Right.
It really was like they were NPCs at some level. You really couldn't have a good conversation with them, and they really weren't saying anything that interesting.
And they weren't necessarily spelling all that well. So you went on from Total Annihilation Kingdoms, I guess, to work on kids' games, right?
I'd worked at Lucasfilm, and I'd done the two Monkey Island games, and then I left Lucasfilm to start up Humongous Entertainment and did the kids' games there for several years, and then hired Clayton Kozlarik and Chris Taylor, and they were really the ones that did Total Annihilation. I was the producer on it, but they were kind of the key creative and technical and art leads on that game. But that came after that I had started doing the kids products.
Right. What drove you to working on kids games, having kind of established a fan base with so-called true gamers or something like that?
Well, I think the kids games were very appealing to me because they were, at least the ones I were doing, they were still very standard adventure games. I mean,
right.
If you play, you know, Putt-Putt or Pajama Sam or any of those, they're just classic hardcore adventure games. But they're just kind of scaled down for kids. The scope is much smaller. And that was just very appealing to me because, you know, rather than spending a year plus working on a game, you know, I could do these in 6 months, you know, 9 months. It was a lot more opportunity to kind of be able to go through a lot more design process and iterations. And also, it was kind of getting to this point about then where people were getting a little more fixated about the graphics on things.
Yeah.
And the kids' games I really liked because the kids just didn't care about the graphics. It was completely irrelevant to them. They cared about story and they cared about character. And, you know, those were the things that I was very interested in when I was doing Monkey Island and Maniac Mansion were stories and characters. And I think the kids' games just kind of gave me an avenue to really focus on that stuff and not worry so much about what people were thinking of the technology.
Right. Well, considering a lot of game players are still in it, they're getting older and starting families now. What do you think the future is of games for kids and so on?
You know, I think it's pretty bleak.
Yeah.
And I think that's really too bad. I think, you know, kind of what happened was the licensed products just overwhelmed the kids' business. And
Harry Potter or something.
Harry Potter's and, you know, at Humongous we did the Blue's Clues license, which was the first licensed product we did. And the sales of that product just dwarfed everything else we had done.
Right.
I mean, our products before that had sold really well. And the Blue's Clues stuff just dwarfed everything. And so, you know, you kind of look at that and you go, wow. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And I think that really happened. And, you know, a lot of the big companies, you know, the Learning Company was kind of sold to Mattel and everything just kind of collapsed. The retailers became very, very fixated on getting licensed product in. And it just kind of became, you know, a marketing channel for television shows and movies and cartoons rather than it did kind of an independent creative medium. And I think that is really too bad. Because I think there's just so much that you could do with doing kid software that wasn't just curriculum drilling programs, which we never were. I mean, we were games. We were things for kids to have fun with, not educational stuff.
Do you think the same bleak future applies to independent gaming in general? Or
yeah, independent gaming is, you know, it's interesting. I think, you know, it's got a lot of potential out there, but it's, you know, it's got to go somewhere. I worry a little bit about it because, you know, I spend a bunch of time looking at independent games and trying to play independent games. And there isn't a lot of stuff out there. It's, you know, the craftsmanship is not very high. There's some good creativity out there. There's some good gameplay. There's some really interesting games, but the craftsmanship just can't compete with the commercial stuff. And I think that's always going to keep it down as opposed to, say, independent film. You know, an example I always use is a movie like Napoleon Dynamite. I mean, that movie was made for $250,000. But you go watch it in a theater and it looks like a Hollywood movie.
Right.
The lighting's all perfect. The audio's perfect. The directing, you know, everything. The craftsmanship of the movie is just as good. And so that allows the audience to go view that movie in the same light that they would view a regular Hollywood movie. But we don't have that parity in the games business.
Right.
The independent games don't have that same production value. And it's not really, you know, the developers' fault. They just don't have the money in order to compete at that level. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying at the beginning, was that we don't have this kind of lockdown set of tools. We don't have this kind of fixed environment for doing things like the movies. I mean, you want to make a movie, you can go to any place in any city and rent professional equipment, and you buy standard film, and you know, you get some people who know about that stuff, and it's just not that way in games.
Right.
That's why, you know, I would like to see this kind of technology stuff level out at some point, and then I think, you know, we're going to see some more of that stuff.
Yeah, so that way people aren't even just talking about things like frame rates and bugs and things like that.
Frame rates and polygon counts and shaders and all these other things should be so irrelevant to anybody playing games.
You've got an Xbox 360, right? What do you think of the stuff happening on like Xbox Live Marketplace? Have you messed around with that stuff?
Yeah, I think that stuff is kind of interesting. Yeah. I mean, certainly things like Geometry Wars are, you know, a lot of fun, and I have probably spent more time playing that game than anything else on the Xbox 360. I think that's a really interesting channel. It does worry me a little bit because it's not an open channel. It is a completely locked down channel controlled by Microsoft.
Right.
And I am a little bit concerned that some of the larger companies, you know, the EAs and Activisions and, you know, Take-Twos of the world are going to start to see that as a viable channel, not necessarily to do small original content, but, you know, to pump small versions to promote their licenses. And I think that could really destroy that. I mean, I just hope that Microsoft keeps that channel very, very open to independent people, because you can make a good game on that for a smaller amount of money. I mean, you're still talking about a big chunk of money, but, you know, nowhere near 20 million. So I just hope they understand what that could do for the business.
It certainly seems to have a purity of spirit there so far, but yeah, that's an interesting kind of hypothetical case. I could totally see that, just the Halo side-scrolling game that comes out 6 months before Halo 3
And you are seeing a lot of that stuff in production.
That type of thing seems to have practically overwhelmed the casual games market at this point, too, or at least you know, mobile games and so on. It's all just licensed kind of marketing cash-ins now.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the mobile game business is like that. I don't even consider that to be the games business in a way. That's just an extension of the marketing department of, you know, film companies and whatever.
So what is the main thing that you or things that you think have changed in game development since when you were getting started working on Maniac Mansion and Secret of Monkey Island, stuff like that? How's it different now?
Well, I think it's bigger. Yeah. I mean, I think that's probably the biggest change that's happened is it's just a much bigger industry. There's a lot more money at stake. And as soon as you start spending millions of dollars to make something, it's a lot harder to just kind of go off with a small team and make something and see if it's interesting or not, because you have a lot of money on the line. You have marketing departments, you have PR departments, you have all these people now, because it's an event in a way. And so I think that makes it a lot harder to just kind of rush out and do different things. You know, success is 90% failure. And if you can't have the opportunity to fail, you're just not going to be able to do interesting things. And I think that is one of the problems that the games business has now, is there is just no room for that failure to try new things.
But the failure happens anyway, doesn't it?
It happens, but they're not good failures.
Right.
You know, it's like you can look at any kind of song, music, movie, anything, and you can go, yeah, that's really bad, but, right? And you can pull all these really good things out of it and go, you know, I can use these in mine, or I know they're going to do it better the next time. But I think you have a lot of failures in games that are just failures because nobody tried, nobody cared. It was all about marketing. It was, you know, those aren't the right reasons to fail.
Right. But despite all this, you're still at it, right?
You know, nobody's going to hire me to do anything else, so I'm stuck in this business.
But are you saying it's just a job?
No, it's not a job at all. I mean, if I just wanted a job, I would, you know, go do something else. But I think it's fun. I mean, I've been in this business almost since its inception, and I enjoy it at some level, as frustrating as it can be.
Right.
I don't want to do anything else. I like to do this.
Just got
to
get some of the obstacles out of the way, huh?
Yeah, it's pushing through. It's trying to find publishers that are, you know, kind of willing to take a risk on, you know, different types of games, smaller budget games. So far, that's, you know, that's not really the mindset that they have, but yeah. I keep pushing forward.
Do you think the circumstances are such that some of these guys who've been really risk averse are going to have to start taking more risks? I mean, you can't just put out another World War II themed first person shooter and hope that's going to be a huge success anymore, right? It seems like people's demands are changing somewhat.
Well, I think they have to change.
Yeah.
You know, will they change? I don't know. But they have to change.
Right.
I mean, if this really is going to be a creative force on par with, you know, movies and music and a lot of other art forms, it has to change. It has to become a multi-tiered business where you have the blockbusters at the top that are making a lot of money. And then you have all these other tiers of games that are being professionally produced, you know, by the publishers, being sold to people. And when you get that kind of tiered system, it's a great system to have because you can bring in people at the bottom. You can spend a little bit of money, you know, getting their project made. You can help develop talent there. You can get new ideas. You can breed studios. There are all these things you can do with that system, but we don't have that. We just have maybe the top two layers of that system. We don't have any of that other stuff underneath it, and that has to change in this business.
Right. But you think others see it this way as well, right?
I think a lot of people see it like this.
So what's going to happen? Is someone going to mobilize an army and make this work? Or?
Well, I think one of two things will happen. I think that either the whole business will collapse at some point just because it's so top heavy that it just cannot sustain itself. And, you know, it'll be reborn in a different way. Or somebody will just do that and will win really big and everybody will copy it. You know, it could take somebody like Electronic Arts going, you know, we're going to start another brand. It's going to be a whole separate brand and we're going to fund lower budget projects. And, you know, we're going to, you know, get these more independent developers and we're going to give them the support. We're going to give them the money. So the craftsmanship is up there. And all it's going to take is for them to win at that. And everybody else will do it. Everybody will see the advantages, but somebody's got to do it first.
Yeah. Well, here's hoping. On a separate subject, your games are known for their humor. Why do you think so few games are funny, even still?
'Cause, well, you know, comedy's hard.
Yeah,
it really is. I think, you know, it's one of those things that it's very tough to do comedy. I think there's a lot of issues that make a comedy particularly hard in games. In some ways, comedy is all about timing.
Right.
And in games, you've turned the timing over to the player. And so it is very, very difficult to do kind of that timing and pacing oriented comedy in games.
Unless it's in like a non-interactive cutscene or something like that. And that's,
yeah. And those I don't think are particularly funny either because, you know, I don't play games to watch a movie. I play games to play a game. So if I'm going to have humor, it needs to come very quick in very short little bursts. And, you know, I think you can do kind of, you know, a lot of slapstick humor and stuff in games. But doing that kind of more sophisticated humor, I think, is just very hard. And, you know, honestly, I think the real problem is that, you know, game developers just aren't that funny. I really think it's that simple.
They're good at explosions.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, and then there's some people, you know, like Tim Schafer, who's, you know, a genius at that kind of comedy stuff. But, you know, there's Tim Schafer.
Indeed.
And, who else? There's Tim Schafer. You know, there just aren't a lot of people that are working in this business that I think are really kind of that intrinsically funny and understand comedy.
Right. You worked with Tim Schafer for a while, right?
Yeah, I hired Tim Schafer at Lucasfilm.
Nice. Sure, he owes you for that.
Oh, I keep reminding him of that, but he seems to forget.
What was it like working with a guy like that?
It was great. You know, we hired Tim Schafer and Dave Grossman, who hired them both at the same time, and they were both on Monkey Island, and they're both just incredibly funny people, but in very different ways. You know, Dave Grossman is very kind of a dry, sarcastic humor, where Tim's is just a little more in your face. Which was great having them work on the same project because I could really kind of assign them to, you know, to different characters in the game and different scenes depending on kind of how I wanted the comedy for that thing to work. But they were great. They were great to work with.
Chris Taylor is a funny guy in real life too, isn't he? A guy who is credited for kind of being the creative force behind Total Annihilation.
Yeah, Chris is a very funny guy, and then he does serious, violent RTS games. You know, he seems to have absolutely no interest in, you know, taking his humor and applying it to games, which always kind of confused me with him.
Well, whatever works, right? As long as people like the,
you know,
the
if you love what you're doing, then great.
Have you seen much on Supreme Commander? The game he's working on now.
I've actually seen nothing at all on it.
Looks cool. I mean, everyone seems to recognize the roots who played Total Annihilation back in the day. So some concepts, I guess, don't go out of style. we're talking about all these games from way back when. What's it like to be best known for works that happened a while ago, frankly?
You know, I think it's great that people, like I was saying earlier, people still play that stuff. That people are still playing Monkey Island, they're still into Monkey Island, there's still Monkey Island websites that are, you know, still being updated on a daily basis. And I think it's really great, you know, to have created something and worked on something that, you know, even to this day, people are still interested in and still, you know, very fixated on for some people. So I think that's great. It's great to have done that.
Do you intend to top that, or are you content that it's going to be hard to live up to something like that?
No, I very much want to top it. I mean, I'm currently working on a game that's kind of a combination of an RPG and an adventure game, kind of taking the elements of those two things that I enjoy the most and kind of, you know, putting them into something. You know, I'm designing that. I'm out pitching that to publishers right now, which is, you know, it's a very hard pitch. And, you know, I think that game really will bring a lot of those things that people just loved about those games, you know, to something a little more current. So, yeah, I definitely want to try to top all that stuff.
And speaking of Monkey Island, did you ever plan on revealing what exactly the secret is, or is that...
I had definitely planned on doing that in the third game. Yeah, there's no question about that. But, you know, Jonathan and Larry made Monkey Island 3, which is a great game. I think they did a fabulous job on that. You know, they didn't know what the secret was. I told nobody. So, you know, they weren't really able to kind of reveal that. But, I mean, I would love to make another Monkey Island game.
Yeah.
I mean, if I could make another one, I mean, I have this whole story mapped out in my head for how I want to tie it all together with the other two games, kind of bring it all back to the original thing. That would just be a dream of mine.
So you want to hold on to the secret just in case.
Yeah, you know, I should probably write it down and, you know, give it to my lawyer to review on my death.
Yeah,
I keep saying that, but then I think, God, do I really want that? Because, you know, some crazed fan is going to figure, well, you know, I know how to get the secret.
Rub them out.
Exactly.
See, I have already thought of it. So that could be the premise of the next Hitman game or something like that. You've probably seen, like, Pirates of the Caribbean and stuff like that. I've heard before that The Ride was some of your kind of a spiritual inspiration for that series or what have you. Is that true?
There were really two things that really inspired me for that game. One was The Ride, Pirates of the Caribbean, and the other was a book that I read called On Stranger Tides. And I think those two things kind of coming together were really the kind of genesis behind that whole idea. Yeah.
Do you like the movie?
I love the movie. The movie was great. I went into the theater just expecting to hate it. Just go, oh my God, this is going to be horrible. It's going to be same old crappy stuff. But, you know, they just nailed it.
Yeah.
They nailed just every piece of that. If there was a Monkey Island movie, I'd want it to look like that.
Yeah. Surprises do happen. That movie did seem to have just about everything going against it. A Disney movie based on a ride. So.
Well, you know, the Haunted House movie came out at the exact same time. And where's that?
I saw that on a plane. So I can, you know, I've seen worse, but hey. Speaking of movies, what's the last movie you watched? Do you watch a lot of movies? You've been talking.
Yeah,
about
I watch a lot of movies. I saw the last movie I saw was actually last night was the Prairie Home Companion movie.
Any good?
I liked it actually. It's Robert Altman did it, and I'm really a big fan of Robert Altman movies, so I kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah, if you want to talk comic timing or at least a good dialogue.
Yeah, he's got great dialogue. It's also one of the things, you know, I love about Woody Allen movies.
Right,
it's just
right.
The dialogue. It's just fabulous to just kind of go listen to it all.
Yeah. Can you think of many games that actually had good dialogue in them from your perspective?
Well, you know, if it wasn't done by Tim.
Right.
You know, Tim's games always have really great dialogue in them, but most of the time it's just, it's like, you know, fingers down a chalkboard.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because the writers don't really understand the interactive medium.
Right.
And I think what happens is a lot of game companies will go hire, you know, Hollywood writers to write their stuff. And these people are very good at writing scenes and they kind of understand that, but they don't understand the process of interactive writing. They don't understand how you kind of turn the whole story inside out when you're doing that. So what they tend to do is they tend to write cut scenes for you, but they don't really flow together very well.
Right.
And so it's just not that interesting.
You've probably seen how there's all this now college curriculum around gaming because, you know, there's a lot of money in the business and people want to get into it in a more formal way. Do you have high hopes for that stuff or do you think they're not teaching practical material there?
I do have high hopes for that. I think that kind of stuff is absolutely critical to this business. I mean, we need to have, you know, really good curriculum, much like film school that people can go to. They can produce interesting things. They can learn the craftsmanship. They can learn the creative piece of the business and be able to, you know, come out and do stuff. I think it's absolutely critical. I really support that stuff. But I don't know that they're doing all the right things yet. I mean, it's so very, very early. You know, it's a lot of it, they're still attached to the computer science programs.
Right, right.
You know, they need to get divorced from that. I mean, the game design stuff, it needs to be in the same groups that are doing the theater and the writing and the film. It is not computer science.
Maybe much like with what you talked about where, you know, it's going to take some blockbuster kind of indie game from some spin-off brand. Maybe all it takes is some relatively well-known game designer emerging out of a college curriculum like that to set it ablaze.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, film schools have been around for a long time, but you know, you suddenly started to get these people, these, you know, when George Lucas came out of film school and, you know, Scorsese and all these people, that's when you kind of started to really realize, oh, the film school, it's not a trade school.
Right.
And I think we need to have that happen at some point in our future.
So these days you're working on the game project you mentioned.
Yeah, I'm
doing. Is that taking up most of your time?
You know, it doesn't take up a lot of time. You know, a lot of it is just, you know, calling up publishers and trying to make contacts and talking to people and, you know, trying to, you know, push the idea through, which is, you know, a pretty uphill battle for what I'm trying to do since it's not, doesn't really fit into that mainstream game mold. I've been doing some work with Casual Games, which is also, you know, a very kind of interesting alley off the mainstream game development stuff. That's very, very, very fascinating. It's interesting to work on games that are very small teams again, where it's just, you know, one programmer and a couple of artists or a couple of programmers. I think that stuff's interesting. Yeah. The Casual Games business from a business standpoint is also very fascinating to see how kind of that's all evolving. And is, you know, is that going to go anywhere beyond, you know, just kind of these soccer mom games? Is that going to somehow come around and merge with the hardcore gaming? Or, you know, even better, is it going to create this whole different type of gamer out there? That stuff's interesting to see.
Yeah, Microsoft was talking about that Xbox Live Anywhere stuff where you might have all this stuff interacting one day where you've got your kind of lighter portable version of your game on your handset or something, and then your progress transfers over to your console, stuff like that.
Right.
So how did you get your start making games, and what made you get into that stuff in the first place?
Well, I started actually quite a while ago. My father was a physics professor, and so he had access to, you know, some of the very first little, you know, microcomputers, as you know, before the Apple II came out. And you know, I just kind of got exposed to that stuff. And you know, when you're a kid and you're exposed to that stuff, what do you want to do? You want to do games, and,
right?
You know, I was playing arcade games, and you know, the Atari 2600 had just come out. And so, you know, I was just fixated on games. So as I started to learn to program, it was all about games. That's what I did. So that kind of just, you know, really jump-started that stuff. And then I got a Commodore 64 and was programming that. And I wrote an extension of the BASIC language that was a part of it to allow people to do graphics and sound. And the Commodore had great graphics and sound for that time, but there was no way to access them without, you know, doing peek and poke commands or dropping to assembly language. The BASIC that came with it had no ability to access the graphics. And so me and a friend, we came up with a whole extended BASIC language that sat on top of the BASIC that was in the Commodore, which, you know, gave you control over sprites and audio and all sorts of stuff. And we sold that to a company in California, and they really liked it, and they offered me a job. So I took it, and so I came and started to make games for them. And they went bankrupt about 6 months after I started. So I was, you know, heading back and, you know, going to figure out what I was going to do. And then I got a call from somebody at Lucasfilm because they were looking for a Commodore 64 programmer to port some of their old Atari games. So that's how I got on at Lucasfilm.
Rest is history. Well, seeing as not everyone will have a chance to write extensions of Commodore 64 basic programming, do you have any advice to the guys out there who at least think they want to get into game development?
You know, in a way, I kind of feel sorry for them because it's so complicated these days. You know, when I was getting into this, you could just sit down with BASIC and you were, you know, moving characters across the screen, and that was state of the art. And today, you know, getting into something is just, you really do have to kind of understand it. I would say, you know, to start with things like Flash, stuff where you're not becoming overwhelmed with the technology, because I mean, if you're interested in programming, that's one thing. If you're interested in game design, that's another thing. And starting with something like Flash, which is primarily a visual tool, it kind of allows you to explore some of the game design issues without, you know, being weighed down with technology.
Right.
But it's a hill to climb.
Yeah. especially since a lot of people want to be in there, or at least think they do.
Maybe it's becoming
a bit like film in that regard, at least, right?
Right. Everybody wants to direct.
Yeah, be a Hollywood star. To further complicate things, what do you think about all the games and politics stuff that's happening, like the ESA suing the state of Oklahoma and all that? Do you follow that stuff?
Yeah, I follow that stuff pretty closely. Yeah. I mean, I feel pretty strongly about that stuff. Yeah, I think, you know, we do have to worry. I think that a lot of the stuff that happened to the comic book business really destroyed it as an art form for a long, long time. I mean, I think it's only kind of recently reemerged. And so I think we need to be very careful about that kind of stuff. But on the flip side, you know, as the people creating this stuff, I think we do have responsibility to create good, interesting, you know, healthy things. It doesn't mean that we can't do violence or shouldn't do violence or even shouldn't do horrible violence. But I think, you know, we need to understand that what we do is affecting people. And it's, you know, not that I think that, you know, your game is making you go out and shoot people, but it does affect people. You know, games are part of popular culture. They drive popular culture. And so we are affecting that popular culture. And I think we need to be aware of that. You know, I think there's a good balance there. But, you know, creating laws to stop games or stop people from buying games, you know, I think that's just crazy. And I don't think that really stops anything from happening.
Right. At the very least, I hope that this type of stuff is serving to educate people on some level. It seems
hopefully that, I mean, it's hard when you start to get into politics because you know, a lot of people, their motivation really isn't, you know, protecting kids from games or protecting anybody from games. It's all about getting reelected or it's all about something else. And so, you know, you got to kind of look at that and go, okay, well, what's the real reason that somebody's upset about this? You know, it's a hot button issue that will get them reelected, you know, more than it is something that they actually do care about.
Yeah. Do you think the ESA is fighting the good fight with this stuff?
I think they're fighting the good fight with that stuff. Yeah. I mean, I think the games industry, you know, probably needs to, you know, as horrible and sleazy as it sounds, you know, they need to get more involved in the whole lobbying thing. They need to get entrenched in that stuff. Otherwise they will just get rolled over.
That's what Hollywood did, right?
Yeah. You need to be there.
One of the other things you do is you run an interesting website called grumpygamer.com. It's got some cool Flash cartoons on it in reference to what you were saying. What's it all about?
It's interesting. The whole site really came about because I thought it would be fun to program some blogging software. I thought, you know, I've never written one of those. That would be really interesting. And I, you know, this was learning, you know, PHP and some, you know, the server side stuff was kind of fascinating to me. So I just decided to write blogging software. And then I thought, well, I really need to talk about something now. And so I just started talking about the game stuff. And it's interesting, the grumpygamer.com domain I've actually owned for many, many years. I think I actually originally bought that like in 1999. And then it expired for a year and then I renewed it. But it was actually going to be a site that reviewed game reviews.
Oh, nice.
So it's like I would go read a review and then I would review the review. Huh. So that was kind of my weird little brainstorm. Wow. And, you know, that lasted for, you know, like 5 minutes.
I'd like to see a site like that. What's your present take on game reviews? Has your opinion changed much over the years? Perhaps not.
You know, I don't read a lot of reviews on games. I don't read a lot of movie reviews, you know, either on that stuff. No offense on any of this stuff.
None
but
taken.
I would like to see game reviews being a little more hard-hitting on stuff. They seem more like product reviews. It seems like they're reviewing refrigerators for Consumer Reports. And I would like to see game reviews be more about the artistic nature of the games. And I mean, not that there aren't really bad movie reviewers out there. I mean, there's so many movie reviewers that are all about just getting their name in the paper, you know, underneath the thing. But I think there are movie reviewers who are kind of interested in it as an artistic medium.
Yeah.
And I would like to see more game reviews that really kind of concentrate on that rather than being kind of a Consumer Reports thing.
I think there is a chicken and egg thing there to a certain extent, to your earlier point, that once some of the technology stuff plateaus, it'll just be a lot easier to hunker down and focus on the actual creative elements than get hung up on how long the loading times are.
Right. No, it's very, very true.
One of the things I noticed on your site is that it says you're boycotting Sony. How's that been working out for you?
You know, it's been working out fine since I didn't really buy anything from Sony anyway. I'm kind of a fair weather boycotter.
No, not pre-ordering the PlayStation 3. anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, with that whole thing that they did with the DRM on the CDs, which I thought was just completely outrageous for them to do. But, you know, I think they kind of got what they deserved on that. So
yeah.
I think that all kind of, you know, turned out for the best on that situation with them.
They get a little strict about things like that sometimes, don't they? The proprietary formats and...
Yeah, Sony in general seems to have a problem with that. You know, I think, you know, going all the way back to, you know, Betamax, right, and, you know, their proprietary memory sticks and their proprietary music players, and they just love their little proprietary stuff, which,
yeah,
I don't know that it's ever really worked out for them.
Guess they're trying it again with Blu-ray, and
right.
We'll see how that goes. I guess I should make sure to talk about Nintendo just in all fairness. It seems like you'd be maybe cautiously optimistic based on what you've been saying and with what they're trying to do with the Wii and all that. What do you think of it?
Well, I've got a lot of respect for Nintendo. I think, you know, Nintendo has always tried to do things that were just a little bit different, right, and I think that's great. They've always tried new things. I mean, I can't imagine any other company coming out with something like Animal Crossing. You know, I don't know about the Wii. I don't know where I stand on that little waving device, and I don't know that, you know, I'm going to want to be jumping around my living room,
yeah,
when I play my games. I'm just not convinced that that's the kind of thing that, you know, I'm going to be wanting to do. But I don't know. I mean, I think they have a good track record of, you know, trying things that people think are kind of dumb and then succeeding. So
yeah,
I want to
kind
I
of against all odds.
See, yeah.
That'll be interesting. And in fact, maybe Nintendo has some of the stuff going that you were talking about where, you know, on the one hand, they can always fall back on Zelda and Mario and Metroid, and they still make great games in, right, in those series. But on the other hand, they are doing this stuff like, I mean, Animal Crossing just seemed really bizarre before it came out, like,
yeah,
the original,
no, very
GameCube
true,
one.
And, you know, I have to say, when I first read about the Nintendo DS with the dual screens, I thought, that's just a dumb gimmick. But you know what? It actually worked really well.
Yeah.
So I will give them the benefit of the doubt. I mean, they've earned my trust enough that I will give them that benefit.
And if nothing else, it's supposed to be the cheapest one out of the new crop, so it won't hit people,
yeah,
in the wallet that hard.
Those console games are pretty expensive. Although, I don't know if you saw that thing on the web where somebody had done a comparison of console prices adjusted for inflation. It's actually very, very fascinating because the consoles, you know, the 360 and stuff, really aren't that expensive.
Yeah. I mean, game systems always used to be like,
yeah,
$200, except,
yeah, I mean,
this was
the Atari 2600 was more expensive than the Xbox 360 adjusted,
yeah,
for inflation.
And back in the day, I don't even remember what I had to do to convince my parents to buy me a Phantasy Star for the Sega Master System, which retailed for, I think, $69, you know, back in 1987 or something. So, I mean, it's hugely expensive. And,
well, you know, my parents wouldn't buy me an Atari 2600,
yeah,
which is probably what got me into this industry, because I had to program my own games.
Nice. Build them your own damn self. I think it was one of the first things you wrote on your site about why adventure games suck.
Right.
So why do they suck, and can they both suck and be dead at the same time?
Well, that was something I actually wrote back in 1989.
Yeah.
I wrote that actually before Monkey Island came out.
Wow.
So it's quite an old article. But, I think a lot of it is still true, not only for adventure games, but just, you know, games in general.
And are the main points things you've brought up here?
Well, you know, the main, I think they're probably a little more nitty-gritty design,
yeah,
type issues, but, you know, the main points are just kind of about simplicity. It's about, you know, structuring the events that the player receives. It's about, the user interface should not be the game. And there's just a lot of stuff like that. I mean, one of the things that really drove me to do Maniac Mansion with kind of the parserless adventure game was I was just tired of playing that second guess the parser game where the designer had not thought of enough synonyms for this tree.
Right.
And I just was tired of typing tree, plant, bush, you know, over and over again, trying to figure out what the hell it was called. And I think, you know, some things like that about the game shouldn't be the interface.
Yeah.
You know, the interface should vanish. At some point, I should not even understand there is an interface anymore because,
right,
it's really just about the game.
There's still some analogous situations to that even today, right? I mean, where no one's doing parser games, but there's still kind of trying to guess what the designer is thinking.
Well, yeah, I think the analogy today is probably these overly complex console controllers that, you know, I feel like I need a pilot's license, you know, in order to be able,
right,
to operate the thing. And I think, you know, I think it has a potential of making designers lazy because now they have too many buttons. they don't need to really worry about kind of simplifying that experience into the game, you know, through the controller. Because, well, we just have another button. You know, we got six buttons on the back of the thing. We got four buttons up front. And so, you know, we'll put it on a button.
And then he could press and hold certain buttons and press other buttons.
Right. And I think that's, in a way, that's kind of sloppy UI design.
Yeah.
And I would love to see simpler controllers.
And that's what it's going to take to get new people into games, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you hand an Xbox 360 controller to somebody who's not a gamer and they have no idea what to do with this thing. It's intimidating.
Yeah.
You know? And games cannot be intimidating. If we want to attract new people into here, they've got to be things that are simple on the surface, that they're easy to get into, but then can have some kind of emerging complexity that will really keep them attracted.
Well, anything else you want to add or talk about?
You've covered a huge range of topics here.
Well, thank you very much for your time. Well, that's a wrap for this episode of Designer Threads. Thanks very much to Ron Gilbert for taking the time out. You can visit his site at grumpygamer.com and buy a bunch of used copies of his old games while you're at it. I'm Greg Kasavin. Until next time.